Hey, what is up? This is Kevin from Kevin's Barbecue Joints, and welcome to episode 9 of the Kevin's Barbecue Joints podcast. This one's awesome. You're going to love this. This is Nick Solaris from Eaters the Meat Show. I've wanted to talk to him for a long time to get his history and to learn more about how he parlayed all this into a successful writing and photography career. We get into depth about his original website, his Beef Aficionado website, and then how he grew that to writing gigs. And then we talk in depth about his trips to Texas. He's been going to Texas every year with a group of guys, and it just sounds amazing. And you can follow along on Instagram, and it'll make you want to go to Texas so badly. We talk about cameras. His photography is incredible, and we get kind of in depth, and I ask him a lot of questions about his equipment he uses. If you're really into photography or want to be into photography or want to get better at photography, I think that little snippet, that portion of the podcast you'll love. Overall, we just talk about meat and the barbecue scene in New York and other places that go, even steak and prime rib places, and it's just... a little all over the place, but in the best possible way. Please subscribe. I'll be adding at least 2 of these per week, but enjoy this.
We were talking earlier about this. Yes. This is not the coffee, because the one that I used was completely tattered, but just to give the viewer a preface, Beef Aficionado was my personal food blog that basically was my entree into food writing and was a hobby, but then became my full-time job. But the reason it happened was partially because of this, but also because I used to go to Smith & Walensky every Sunday, which is a very famous New York City steakhouse.
Yes.
Going back to the 80s when my whole family moved here from London, which is why I speak funny. And they all moved back. I stayed. But part of my sort of ritual of living in New York, we all have these rituals in the places we live, right? And that's why what barbecue and meat eating is so compelling, is because there's such a ritualistic aspect to it. So I used to go to Smith & Walensky every Sunday. I get the same thing, the dry-aged prime rib. Still my favorite thing to eat all these years later. And, you know, after a point, I was like, God, there's got to be other steakhouses in New York, you know? And back then, this was the way you find out about restaurants. So, yeah, I think through this, and I was like, I started off in the section that was just best steak, right? And I was happy to see Smith & Walensky in there. But this is the list from 2002.
Okay, this is interesting.
Peter Luger's, Sparks, Palm, Morton's of Chicago. I don't know what the F that is. This is a family show, so I'll curtail my cursing.
It's not a family show.
Post House and Smith & Walensky. So Smith & Walensky and Post House are actually owned by the same restaurant group. Morton's of Chicago is a wet-aged chain from Chicago.
I live above a Morton's currently.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Actually, you know what? They serve prime beef. I'm just not a fan of chains from outside of New York in New York any more than I'm a fan of New York chains in other places, you know? But Pete Luger's is still amazing. Sparks is an amazing experience. They don't serve dry-aged beef anymore, and I'm a big proponent of that. But it's still a great, you know. The Palm is closed. The original is closed. It's now kind of a diluted chain. But these, like Pete Luger's and I think Smith & Walensky would still rank among the best steaks in New York, but this list is like, the steaks that we're eating now are so far above that. So anyway, I went through this list, I ate at all of these places, and then I went through basically every steakhouse. And back then, there wasn't that many. There was maybe 30 or 40, which seems like a lot, but we're talking about 8 million people, and a lot of them carnivores.
What were you doing at the time? Were you writing or...?
Tattoo shop. I was not writing. Okay. I have a writing background. I have a degree in history, and a lot of my writing is sort of historically based, kind of informed by history.
You could tell.
But back then I owned a tattoo shop with a former girlfriend, and you know, had a pretty leisurely lifestyle, so I had kind of time to explore, you know, the fineries of eating meat in a cosmopolitan setting. So basically, Beef Aficionado, I had a website before that, but there was no easy, you know, you had to sort of learn HTML, to learn coding, right? As soon as Blogger came out in 2005, the Google software, it was as easy as filling out a form on the internet and hitting enter and you could publish, right? So I basically started publishing Beef Aficionado 11 years ago or so, 10, 11 years ago.
Okay.
And that is still, I mean, a lot of that is still up. Like, that was the second iteration of my website. The original is long gone because, you know, there's no, you know, I don't even know who hosted it anymore. It's like, it's that, you know, that lost antiquity.
But I would go to your site all the time.
So Beef Aficionado basically led to me getting hired by Serious Eats almost within a few months of starting.
Okay, that's what it was. Okay.
Yeah, so Serious Eats was really the first pure food blog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there was other food websites, but they were sort of attached to publications, right? And then there was also Eater, which is where I've ended up, mm-hmm. which was not a food blog per se, but it was a restaurant blog. And I think those things are quite different.
For sure.
It's funny that Eater has gone more towards being a pure, I mean, it's more of, it's a food publication now, mm-hmm. I think. But restaurants still very important in that. And also to me, I'm all about restaurant dining. I can cook, but I don't like to let people know that because then they'll expect me to cook. You know? So much better to leave it to the professionals.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So I started there, and then I wrote for Serious Eats for 7 years.
Oh, wow, okay.
Hamburger reviews, pizza reviews, restaurant reviews.
All New York, or did you travel?
New York. I traveled at the beginning a fair amount. I was in L.A. quite a bit because of another girl. You know, I have these – my relationships, like, they never last, and the women come to their senses, but they do sort of provide me these amazing experiences in life, like flying to L.A. like 3 times a year or owning a tattoo shop. There's a reason why I'm single. Anyway.
Same with me.
Let's get back to meat.
Your girlfriend is meat now.
Yeah, well, it's the most faithful thing in my life is meat.
That's true. That's not a girlfriend, but yes.
My barbecue
right now. Oh, very nice. I want to talk to you about that too.
Oh yeah, it's interesting because that is sort of my barbecue tour that I do every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of really not tied to my job as a food writer, even though obviously there's no way to sort of to unlink the two completely. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that. But yeah. So then. Wrote for Serious Eats for 7 years. Also wrote for AM New York, which is a daily newspaper here.
Okay.
And that actually has a really, like several hundred thousand circulation. They give it out free in the subway, so.
Oh, cool.
Wrote for them. I wrote for a bunch of those airline magazines.
Really?
Which is, yeah, they, you know, just like, if you're coming to New York, what 3 steakhouses that you should visit?
No, I've seen those lists.
Very well, and it's really sort of pretty easy, you know. But then I got hired, so. Then I got hired by Eater, which had been bought by Vox Media.
Okay.
And I was senior editor, then restaurant editor of Eater New York. So very focused on New York, very focused on restaurants broadly. But obviously with my background, I wrote a lot about meat.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, some maniac decided that I should do a video show. So I did a video show and it turned out to actually do pretty well. And that has sort of become, so the meat show is what I do with Vox. And that's mm-hmm. actually basically what I'm doing now. I'm doing video over everything else.
Was that the early days of YouTube, kind of? Or?
No, that was only like 2 years ago.
Oh, it was only 2 years. Okay, I thought.
Yeah, I was, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a writer / photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But at the that's only, I mean, tangentially, that's what I am. But what I'm really interested in is sort of promoting my aesthetic about meat eating. And that's, you know, that's partly culinary, but it's also cultural. And I find that video is the most effective medium for doing that. And that's what I'm concentrating on now. I'm trying to get a TV show. There's going to be some. I don't think there's any natural product anywhere in my house. And I'm looking around. It's. I don't know if you can see. This is a high tech.
I saw. At first, I thought you were in a library with your ceiling.
It's another reason I'm single. This is should be a bedroom, but it's a home theater / audio room.
Right.
Painted black. It's. Yeah. That tells another story.
Yes.
So
you started the meat show about 2 years ago.
Meat show started about 2 years ago, and it's quite literal. It's me eating meat, telling you about the experience. Not unlike what I do in my reviews and what I've striven to do in terms of contextualizing the experience of dining somewhere within the culture of meat eating and more broadly wherever I am, whether it's England or Japan or, you know, New Orleans or anywhere, Los Angeles. Yeah.
And what was your very first restaurant, do you remember, for the meat show? I was going back through it a couple nights ago just to.
Yeah, the problem now is that they've sort of reordered it on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can look at it.
It's hard to figure out.
I think they've now do it so the more popular stuff gets put up front, which
I think so.
I guess becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy on some level. Anyway, it was Peter Luger's.
Okay.
And I originally shot it as like a 20-minute piece, and it just seemed like really kind of laborious. But then when it was cut down to like 5-minute segments, we did like two or three of them, it actually kind of clicked. And I think that in terms of the where it's being displayed, which was at that point it was Facebook and Eater's website, those are like perfect bite-sized nuggets. And of course now, as Eater, as Facebook is really, you know, it keeps changing the way that it works. Mm-hmm. So now we're finding that those really sort of 1-minute videos are really successful. So the Meat Show might have like two or three different cuts for a given episode.
So you publish them on Facebook as well as YouTube? Is that kind of...
Yeah, I think the Meat Show publishes on Mondays, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And it's usually publishing on Eater.com on Facebook, but sometimes it'll go on YouTube the day before.
Oh, interesting.
It's a three-pronged approach, I guess. And sometimes there'll be like two different cuts of Facebook.
And from the early days, I don't remember seeing the Peter Luger one. I'll have to go back to that one. Do you find that it's edited really well? It's really well done.
Yeah,
the production value is fantastic now.
The production value is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've hired a bunch of really talented. Like, they've invested a lot in video producers, mm-hmm. shooters, mm-hmm. editors. Like, they're all really good. And you know, they make me look a lot better than I should look. You know, at the same time, I think they really capture. Like, it doesn't feel glossy and overproduced. Mm-hmm. Like, it's got a grittiness to it.
Oh, definitely.
Look at some of the other shows those guys do, and they look really slick. It's much more like it's, you know, I like the nuance that they give, right?
I honestly didn't know you had a team until I saw that one video where you kind of highlight your team and eat with your team.
I couldn't do any of that. Are you kidding me? Yeah. I can barely do what I do in front of the camera. There's usually two or three people on it, you know, so it's, and then of course there's people that edited that. That's really the hard part, is not this idiot showing up and eating a hamburger and telling you about it. It's the guys that spend, you know, hours in the editing booth. So full respect to the video team. Like, they're like sort of the unsung heroes.
Oh, for sure.
And then it's like, there's such an immediacy to video, and it's so powerful in terms of conveying a message. At the same time, it takes just as long to produce a video as it does to write, except that I don't have to do the production. I, you know.
No, for sure. I didn't realize about editing until I started editing these.
Oh yeah,
there's a lot to it. It's painstaking.
Yabbering away, like there's so much to sort of, you know, whittle down.
Mm-hmm. So now with the Eater, do you set up like a year in advance as to what you want to do, or is it kind of a thing like for traveling around the United States? Or I know you went to England and then you went.
It's sort of planned quarterly.
Okay.
Right. So, opportunities present themselves. Like, we got flown out to Japan last year. And in fact, I'm going again in September to do Wagyu World Championships.
Fantastic.
So,
killer.
The good thing about Vox is like they're a modern company, so they're flexible and they, you know, they can be pretty nimble.
That's fantastic. No, I've noticed that. I've watched the Japan one. Actually, I watched one of them last night. The one where you went to it looked like a conference almost, or
the banquet dinner.
The banquet dinner. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing experience.
that's fantastic. So now your first time. I know that you love Smith and Lewinsky, but then when was your first real taste of Texas style barbecue, or barbecue in general, that when you started to fall in love with barbecue?
First taste of real Texas style barbecue. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Texas, which I had Texas barbecue cooked by the Salt Lick in the Big Apple barbecue.
Okay.
I'm not going to say anything more about that.
Mm-mm.
Because I plan on going to Texas and I'm going to be diplomatic. But the first time was 9 years ago.
Okay.
Flew down with, and this gets back to this t-shirt right here, Texas Barbecue. Mm-hmm. So every year, for 9 years, a friend of mine has organized a trip where it's five or six guys from New York and five or six guys from Dallas area where he grew up, but he now lives in New York. We all fly into Austin. We get into an RV. We stock it full of beer and, you know, and other drinks. And then we basically drive for like 3 or 4 days from pit to pit. First day is always like right to Franklin, where we've ordered a brisket. You know, that's a tip that people, like, yeah, you can line up. But if there's enough of you, you can pre-order, like, whole briskets, right? So we'll take that and then go back to the SUV and eat in the SUV.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But that's not a bad way to do it. But then we'll go to La Barbecue. We'll hit all of these places within Austin.
Within Austin, yeah.
Then we go out to this, we rent this giant house with, like, 12 bedrooms on a lake. And we sort of camp out there. And then the next day might be, you know, we might go to Luling, then on to, you know, what's the Texas capital of barbecue?
The Lockhart or?
I was joking. Lockhart, then on to Taylor. It always snows. So we would start.
You always have to do snows, yes.
Have to do it. You know, it's always like doing snows in Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's like.
And that's essentially what Daniel said too. Between snows and fire.
Yeah, it's my favorite barbecue joint in Texas is Louis Miller, because the totality of that experience, the sense of history you get in that place, the hospitality.
The food is classic.
You know, but obviously you can see that there's been a change. There's been an influence from without, right?
Oh, for sure.
Like the tug of Austin is undeniable.
Oh, without a doubt. I've noticed recently too. Just seeing different things that they offer,
not just Austin. I mean, last time I was there, which was back in March, they had, like, you know, Mike Mills style ribs, baby back ribs, right? They had lamb lollipops with an Indian spice.
At Louis Miller?
Barbecue is really evolving, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. And then have you gone down to Houston? Did you get a chance last time to go down to
Houston? I've never been to Houston, actually. I'm putting my phone over here. I'm getting distracted. I've never been to Houston. I've done Dallas two or three times. I actually really like Dallas Barbecue. Max, which I know is like, it's a bit of a time capsule. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the modern context of barbecue, people would be like, yeah, this is like, I think they use navel. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken. Or they did at some point. But, you know, their barbecue is not like going and getting one of those supremely live pieces of brisket from Franklin or mm-hmm. from La Barbecue or Pecan Lodge, right? That's very modern barbecue. Mm-hmm. But when you're eating that, and that sauce that they have at Max, have you been to Max?
I have not been there, no. That's on my list for this year.
Max has a sauce that's it's very English. It tastes like it's got Worcester sauce in it. It's a dark brown sauce.
Like HP sauce?
Very much like HP sauce. Kind of HP sauce-ish, right?
But interesting.
A bit thinner, a bit more watery. And it reminds me actually like the mop that they use in mutton barbecue in Owensboro, Kentucky area.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another of my favorite, and I think really one of the lost arts is smoking mutton, and mm-hmm. I think one of the really undiscovered still styles of barbecue is Owensboro style mutton barbecue.
You rarely see that, rarely anywhere
else. Very rarely. Never really had it outside of that area. Whereas you go to like the Carolinas, they have Texas style barbecue, and you know,
you have Texas style barbecue everywhere now.
Yeah.
So now with these strips. So then your first taste when you guys went.
My first taste was actually Ironworks.
Oh, Ironworks.
No, it was the year Franklin opened. We didn't even hit Franklin until the next year.
It was when he had his trailer, or
he was still at his trailer back then. We went from Ironworks. This is how old it was. Like, this is really like we were there right on the cusp of the revolution, because we went from Ironworks to, like, I don't think we hit anything else in Austin. We went to, what the hell is the name of the place? Inman Ranch. Do you know that restaurant? Mm-hmm. That barbecue?
Yeah. Ranch?
It's really old school. We went to Inman Ranch. Then we went out to the Salt Lake.
Did you go to City Market maybe? Or did you?
No, that was on the second. No, we hit those. But City Market, to me, Luling is fantastic. Yeah. It's one of the great places. But we went to the west of Austin. And there wasn't, you know, we went to, what's that pit place? It's actually, they cook over coals.
I'm trying to remember what that is.
I'm spacing on the name,
yeah, but it was that.
But definitely going, you know, when you're east of Austin, that's where all the hill country stuff mm-hmm. is, you know.
So now
that first tour was really kind of, then we hit Kreutz's and we hit, you know, Black's and all those places, but it wasn't until the next year that we hit like Franklin, Snow's, you know, the new school places, because our references at that time, the internet was, it was still in its infancy, right? The whole food blogging thing. Daniel Bourne had full custom.
He had Man Up custom. I mean, Man Up Texas Barbecue with...
Barbecue. But then we were looking at books. And, you know, some of those books were probably 10, 15 years old. But we did end up hitting all of the right old school places, which kind of gave us the perfect juxtaposition for, you know, the revolution that was to come. Because, you know, it's we look at these places as sort of stagnant, but they are so influenced by what's happening in Austin. But, you know, and Aaron Franklin has had, you know, obviously tremendous impact.
Yeah, and it's impacted the rest of the United States and how they do it. Because now now in New York, how have you seen the shift in New York?
So New York has just been an amazing renaissance. Going back to probably 15 years ago was the Big Apple Barbecue. Mm-hmm. So put it this way. Up until 2000, there was probably one barbecue joint worth talking about. And that was run by an English hairdresser who worked for Yves Saint Laurent, went to Texas on tour, fell in love with Texas barbecue, moved to Stamford in like 1988 or 1989, opened Pearson Stick to Your Ribs, and then moved that to Long Island City, which is just across from Manhattan.
Okay.
And was doing like a real sort of multi-regional barbecue menu, but it was North Carolina pulled pork, Texas-style brisket, Kansas City style, you know, burnt ends. It was just a lot of
different. Like a hodgepodge of.
But really solidly done. And in fact, if you talk to a bunch of the guys that are now the prominent pit masters, like Billy Durney, Matt Fisher, they all knew that. They all went to him back. So okay. He had that place from the 80s up until the late 90s, I think, maybe even into the 2000s. But by then, he actually ended up moving. He was smoking offsite, had a restaurant uptown, but never as good as the original place.
Okay.
So what happened about 15 years ago, Danny Myers, Mike Callahan got together with Mike Mills, and they started the Big Apple Barbecue, and that was bringing in pit masters from across America. That was many New Yorkers' first taste of actual pit smoke barbecue. And so I think that laid a really solid foundation. We had Blue Smoke.
I was going to say, they started Blue Smoke, right?
Yeah. And so when Blue Smoke opened, it was them, it was Dinosaur Barbecue, it was
Adam Perlang.
What's that?
Adam Perlang had his place.
Yes, Adam Perlang had Daisy Mays U.S. And those three were all pan-regional, right? They weren't like Texas and Memphis style. They all had ribs from one place and brisket from another. But what they offered was real wood smoke barbecue. Mm. That was like the sort of first wave.
And then Fet Sau? I'm trying to think when Fet was, even though it was, it's...
2006, 2007 was like the wave where we started seeing either distinctly New York style barbecue, Fet Sau, or a distinctly regional barbecue like Hill Country doing, you know, pure Texas barbecue, right? We had Rub Barbecue, which was Kansas, it was Kansas City, but it was really competition style barbecue.
That's Paul Kirk, is that?
It was, and Scott E. Smith, who was the actual pit master. You know, Paul Cook came and set the place up, but the guy that ran it all those years was Andrew and his partner Scott, and they really, you know, it was a very good restaurant, especially for its time.
Well, there was a Rub in Las Vegas, too.
Rub in Las Vegas, it was one out in Long Island, but again, I think with these things, like, you know, they get spread a bit thin, I guess.
For sure.
Sustainable. So then we had Wildwood in the city. Then we saw, like, the real renaissance, though, came probably 4 or 5 years ago when we started seeing Mighty Quinn's, Hometown Barbecue, Delaney Barbecue.
Delaney, I was going to say Daniel.
Fine, right? I think, to me, those are really, like, but again, as with everything else, whether it's food writing, whether it's broadcasting, whether it's cooking, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, right?
For sure.
The reason these guys are so good is because everyone else got to this level that allowed that to happen.
It would not have happened if it wasn't for them.
There's a knowledge. There's, you know, it's also that the butchers understand what they need to do. It's now having good supplies of wood, understanding what the oven's like, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Franklin, that book that he wrote, right? That is like a blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Brisket success.
Oh yeah, and then his YouTube videos too. Now. You know, there's so many people I talk to that have been inspired by those videos. Was it PBS or?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's why the medium itself doesn't matter, right? Whether it's writing or video or photography, it's like it's It's about problematizing that aesthetic.
And before, you would have had to do so much research to even get close.
Yeah, and it's also about that, and also what the audience you can reach. I mean, videos on Facebook, you know, each of the videos on Facebook do millions of views. It's pretty amazing.
And that's something I want to discuss too, about how the food climate has changed. I think people seem to be more voracious towards anything food related, or at least something that inspires them.
Food has become part of popular culture in the way that poetry and art and film and music, you know, people used to go out for dinner and a show. Right now, dinner is the show. You're going to the latest restaurant. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see the latest band. Sorry, I'm killing wildlife here. So it really has become, it's become an activity in and of itself.
And it's...
In a way, speaks to the decline of Western civilization. We're just with the most fundamental and the sort of base things, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a hell of a ride.
I'm really, really curious as to where this is going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think the danger is that it becomes... I think there's two dangers. One, that it becomes so sort of base and obvious, and that we're just eating bacon and peanut butter, right? Mm-hmm. And you're just appealing to the Instagram. The other danger is that it becomes so obtuse and sort of reliant on wealth and becomes all about dining with in the 100-course, $3,000 tasting menu, right? So between those two poles, like, we need to find a tangible and rational way to, one, sort of make this broad and egalitarian at the same time, not sort of kowtow to the most obvious and base,
right? Exactly.
You know, and at the same time, and to me, what's important is sort of preserving these institutions, mm-hmm. right? To me, these old school barbecue restaurants have something that you can never get at the local hot food trailer, right?
For sure.
And that sense of history in a place. And, you know, I love the fact that I can go to Smith & Wolensky and sit in the same chair that I sat with my father 30 years ago, right? And with my girlfriend 10 years ago, and, like, you know, Daniel Vaughan, like, 3 years ago. It's those things that you kind of lose in this rush to modernity and the latest thing, right?
Well, and that's what hopefully we're doing, is at least preserving those old institutions by highlighting them, and hopefully people get excited about them again, or at least continue to be excited about.
Yeah, and I think I think that's important. It's also sort of incumbent on those institutions to adapt to the realities.
Agreed.
There's plenty of places that I think are great on every level other than the food. You know, it's like you can get, but then again, there's places that, like, yeah, it might not be the greatest steak anymore, but there's plenty of steakhouses that are worth their weight in gold, because the food is good enough and everything else falls into place.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, like, how you have your experience with your father, there might be a restaurant that someone's been going to for years. It might be terrible to you and I, but to them, it's the greatest restaurant.
Those are the things that are the intangibles. Like, mm-hmm. we can talk about, yeah, there's a base for, you know, quality fresh beef in a hamburger, mm-hmm. USDA prime beef for steaks, dry aging preferably, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those things are all meaningless if you've been eating somewhere for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like those are sort of inconsequential.
And that's why it's hard to, I try not to argue to death something if I know that someone loves something so much because of those intangibles.
Yeah, and I'm always like Park House Barbecue in Texas, right? People are like, oh, well, it's not that great. I'm like, listen, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. We know they get interesting history, you mm-hmm. know? They'll tell you, they don't season their beef. This is the way they've always done it. This is the way it is. And it is its own thing. Yeah, if you're going to compare that to a piece of brisket from Franklin that probably costs four times as much and is from, you know, it's two different things.
It's really not fair to judge them against each other. It's just...
It's that, not even about judging. It's that they should just be appreciated as part of the same continuum. Right?
For sure.
They're part of the same story. They're part of the story of Austin and of Texas barbecue.
That's true. I've got a question about your photography. I know you're really into photography, and... you have an amazing camera. Can you talk a little bit about your camera and any kind of advice you can give people about photography?
Well, my advice would not to shoot with the camera that I shoot with.
I know. I'd be scared to put it down.
That are really specialized machines. They're very expensive handmade in Germany cameras that, if you appreciate just great engineering and the aesthetics, they're wonderful, wonderful objects of art, mm-hmm. and design and engineering. They produce great image quality, but no better than what you can get with any other camera system, quite frankly. I mean, we're at the point now where, like, the next generation of the iPhone, like, this one isn't quite there yet, but I'm fairly certain that the next generation of the iPhone is going to, like, compete with a really good quality pocket camera, mm-hmm. like the RX100 with Sony. We're going to get geeky for a sec, right? But there's, you know, photography, there's the result, and then there's the process. Mm-hmm. And to me, the process of shooting with a Leica is unparalleled. It's very liberating. You're looking at the real world through this viewfinder that doesn't actually impose any judgment on you. It's just open. So I think that on some level, it's also a very stripped down camera. You have your shutter, you have your aperture. You know, there's certain electronic enhancements, but it's very minimal. So it's very pure essence. You know, it's like Texas brisket. It's like three ingredients.
Does it upload? I was curious. Does it upload to the cloud or something? And then do you have a chip in there? It's a stupid question, but I'm just curious.
No. I have two. I shoot with a Q, which is basically a very expensive point and shoot, full frame. So we're talking about a very big chip. Mm-hmm. And then I shoot with a Leica M system, which is interchangeable lenses.
Okay.
And that's when you really get in trouble with that system because the lenses get very costly. And, you know, as I said, it doesn't do – the result is the same as with other camera systems. The process of making pictures with it is a little different, and that's why I think people appreciate it.
Gotcha.
But basically with the M system, I take the card out, I stick it in my computer, I edit on Lightroom. You know, so there is some processing involved. With the Q, it happens to have an app that you can send to your phone. But all the work that you would see published, basically I've edited on my computer.
Okay. I was curious because your photos are amazing, and I was
thank you. That was an interesting, like, the whole photography thing was an interesting sort of outcome of doing the food blog, because when I got hired by Serious Eats, back then we would do you put a post up with no photograph, and, like, literally nobody would read the post. So very quickly we learned, like, the vernacular of the internet is you need to have a photograph attached to mm-hmm. anything. So we were all basically, you know, told to take cameras with us everywhere.
And that wasn't your first camera, though?
No, I shot film back. So back in the 80s, my ex-wife at the time was a photography major at SBA. So we had a dark room. This was in the analog film days. We had a dark room in our bathroom. So I shot Nikons back then. You know, I have a photography background. That's why I love the Leicas, because it's still aperture, shutter speed, ISO. Things that, like, there's honestly, there's photographers now and really super talented, well-paid photographers that probably don't even know what.
Oh, I'm sure.
They know what those are, but they don't ever need a reason to shoot
at all.
It was a one photo shoot at a club, so I do a lot of interior shots for Rita, you know, and I was shooting the interior of this club restaurant, and this group of people come in, and they, like, three of them had iPhones, and then one had, like, the Sony, one of those little expensive Sonys, and then there was one, like, usherer doing whatever, and I was like, who is this? And they're like, that's a social media team. And I was like, wow. And it's like, they were just using iPhones. Like, you know, the camera is good enough in this day and age for Instagram. I mean, there's times when I'm lugging my cameras around. I'm just like, God, how long is this going to go on for? Like, where did
they catch up? No, but there's something to be said about holding a camera and taking a picture with it.
It is. And also, it's just more considered. Mm-hmm. Right? You're the act of putting that thing up to your eyes, mm-hmm. focusing, framing, it's a whole different process.
So.
iPhone photography.
Oh, it seems, and you just wonder about that amount of photos that are taken in a single day on phones around the world. It's mind-boggling.
I try to take more pictures with my cameras than with my iPhone.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting.
General rule, like I really try to limit the use of this as for, like, okay, I need that barcode or I need this menu.
Mm-hmm. Or you need to search for something maybe if you're.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, use it as a computer as opposed to a camera.
But that's just me, you know, trying to you know, trying to sort of trying to navigate through the morass of digital imagery. Because otherwise, you're right, you could take 10,000 pictures on this thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my phone is full of easily 10,000 photos. And to go through those,
I'm so sucked into the Apple ecosystem that I have, pay for like 3 terabytes of storage. So I have basically every digital photograph I've ever taken uploaded onto the cloud. Which is kind of scary.
It's wonderful and scary at the same time.
It's wonderful and scary. You see how much things have changed in the 12 years that I've had a Flickr account.
Oh yeah, Flickr. can you recommend, because your knowledge of cuts of meat is pretty impressive? Can you recommend any books that people can read to learn more about, say, the navel or the dorsal or? When I hear you speak, or is it just from learning from?
I mean, I don't know that I ever read a book that, you know, what I read was, I can go grab the NAMP guide, North American Meatpackers Association guide. It's a big thick book like this. It's literally every cut of domestic beef, pork, veal, lamb, chicken. I think there's poultry in there too. That more than anything, there's also a website. And do you have show notes? I can send you a link to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Search for bovine myology. This is basically a 3D rendering of a. I think they do cattle. I think they do lamb, beef, pork. You know, whatever those animals' names are. So I just think of them as meat. And it's pretty amazing. You can literally drag your mouse through and see like the way that the spinalis dorsi tapers down as you get to the posterior of the animal.
Oh,
and
then
you
can
see the rib cuts and you'd be like, oh, that's a ribeye. And it actually isolates muscles. It's very, really good. I'll send you a link to that.
Cool.
I know that it didn't work. I know it required Flash for a long time. So it made it hard to work on apples, but I think they've actually remedied that now. So.
Okay.
But that more than anything was like the way that I was just like, okay, so you put two and two together, you realize that like New York strips and porterhouses kind of the same steak. They just don't have the tenderloin on one side. You also realize that there's very little difference between a rib steak cut from the 13th rib versus a New York strip from the very front short loin. It's basically the same steak.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's very useful. Like that, it just teaches you like the term "high on the hog" really means something. Okay. Comes from the back of the animal, right? Those are all the juicy steak cuts. All come from there. Ribs, New York strips, T-bones, porterhouses. Boom. That's it. Those are sort of the really expensive cuts of meat.
Oh, excellent. Okay, you know, because.
But running through that muscle called the longissimus dorsi, that runs basically through all of those groups that and it's the eye of the ribeye, it's also the eye of the porterhouse, and it's the New York strips.
Okay. Please send that for sure. I definitely want because it just seems like you have but you also have a passion for it. So I think the more passion you have, the more interested you are in
I had a passion for it anyway, so I wanted to educate myself. But then when it became my job, there was a real incumbency to know what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, no, and I feel like a lot of times I don't know what I'm talking about. I know what I like to eat, and I've seen it, but I just can't describe it properly.
Well, that's just, you know, that'll come. It's just practice. Mm-hmm. Practice makes, it doesn't make perfect, but it gets you somewhere there, right?
Makes near perfect, or right. Yards away from perfect, but it's close enough. Are there any restaurants that you're looking forward to? Like, I know that you said you set things up for a quarter. Are there any restaurants that you haven't hit in the United States or any regions that you're looking forward to go into?
Yeah, there's like hundreds and hundreds. And I find them all the time, you know, like, because it's just, as much as we think the internet has made discovery kind of a thing of the past, really not true. There's still great restaurants to be discovered out there. But like definitely Chicago, I haven't been to in decades, and I think that is, apart from being a great meat culture anyway, like what's going on there with places like Alinea and Next, it's really sort of forward thinking.
For sure.
San Francisco, because I want to go to that House of Prime Rib.
I have to go there too. I know. So have you been to Larry's before then, right?
Larry's, yeah, a few times.
Yeah. That for me was my birthday. Every year when I was a child, ever since I was four.
I mean, the place is such a great experience. And they give you that thick cut. And just I love the prime rib cut. So, you know. Yeah, I love it.
It's just the spinning salad. It's very iconic.
Right. Yeah, and again, it gets back to that is part of your history, right? That for that sure. is for a sure. moment, you know, several moments in your life that were like really meaningful, right? So every time you go into that place, you're sort of evoking those memories.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. It's home. Are you working on a book?
I'm working right now. I'm trying to get a TV show.
Okay.
I do have a couple of books in the works. The problem is, I know that as soon as like my book agent basically told me, he goes, yeah, we'll get this accepted as soon as we get the pitch. I'm like, well, I don't want to write the book yet. Like I'm kind of on this like tour right now. So so just look out for The Meat Show.
Okay.
And then I will be hopefully on your television at some point too. But The Meat Show will hopefully live forever.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Nick, for I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Look forward to the next conversation.
Excellent. I'll see you soon.
All right, you take care, Nick. Thanks. All right. Cheers.